This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
In the news this month, a primitive star in our own backyard, Kepler finds a planet with two hosts, and strange goings on in the early solar system. Our current model of the early universe says that, as it expanded and cooled after the Big Bang, quarks began to coalesce to form protons and neutrons, which, when the temperature dropped far enough, began to form simple nuclei. Eventually this material, mainly hydrogen with some helium and trace amounts of lithium, began to clump together, forming the stars and galaxies that we see today. Heavier elements such as carbon, nitrogen and oxygen, in fact pretty much everything that makes up this planet and all of the life on it, were created later by processing of this primitive material in stars and supernova explosions. This processing in nuclear fusion reactions produces all of the rest of the heavier elements in the periodic table. Since less massive stars last longer before running out of fuel, there should be a population of very low-mass stars, which have been around since the early days of the universe. Such stars would be small, dim, and have extremely low proportions of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, and, in a paper published in the journal Nature on September 1st, a team led by Elisabetta Kofo at the University of Heidelberg in Germany have found just such a star in the halo of the Milky Way, but with an unusual chemical makeup. The star, located in the constellation of Leo and known as SDSS J102915+1729-27, has been found to have the lowest amount of elements heavier than helium of all stars yet studied, a quantity known as metallicity. While a few other primitive stars with very low metallicities have been found, the others all have carbon, nitrogen and oxygen in far greater quantities than would be expected for stars from the very first population. It is thought that low-mass stars such as these could only form after the interstellar gas had been enriched by supernova explosions with elements such as carbon and oxygen, since these elements act as a vital cooling agent, reducing the temperature of the gas cloud to the point where gravity can begin to overcome the pressure and cause the clumping which eventually leads to stars. This conclusion means that the low abundance of elements including carbon, nitrogen and oxygen in the newly discovered star does not fit with current models of star formation in the early universe. A further puzzle with this star is the amount of lithium it contains. Its lithium abundance is at least 50 times smaller than that predicted by Big Bang nucleosynthesis. The likely explanation is that the stellar material must have experienced temperatures greater than 2 million Kelvin, the temperature required to destroy lithium. While the chemical composition of this star is something of a challenge to current models of early star formation, along with other examples that should be unearthed in planned surveys, it should provide clues which will help in our understanding of the very first stellar population. Much later in the universe's history, when previous generations of stars had enriched the interstellar gas clouds with significant quantities of heavy elements, planets began to form. The formation of rocky planets such as the Earth requires substantial amounts of elements such as iron, oxygen, nickel and magnesium, so they could not form until at least some of the first generation of stars had died. We currently know of more than 680 extrasolar planets in the Milky Way, with several surveys searching for new examples. One of the latest is Kepler-16b, the first planet confirmed to be orbiting a double star. This so-called circumbinary planet was discovered by the Kepler spacecraft, a probe which stares at the stars in one patch of sky continuously, watching for the tiny dips in brightness caused by planets passing in front of their host stars. So far, the only confirmed planets found by Kepler were orbiting single stars, but since the majority of stars in our galaxy actually exist in multiple systems, this discovery vastly increases the likely number of planets in our galaxy. The research team, led by Lawrence Doyle of the SETI Institute in the USA, used data from the Kepler satellite to find the new planet. The system, Kepler-16, consists of two stars in orbit around each other. The orientation of their orbit is such that, from our point of view on the Earth, as the stars orbit each other, they periodically eclipse one another, causing a drop in brightness as some of the light is blocked by the transiting star. The data, published in the journal Science during September, also showed that dimming occurred when the stars were not transiting each other, implying the existence of a third body in the system. The timing of these eclipse events showed that the additional object was in a wide orbit around both stars, not just orbiting one of them, and the orbital properties and amount of light blocked suggest that the planet has a mass about one-third that of Jupiter and a size similar to Saturn. The planet's density is somewhat higher than Saturn's, however, suggesting a higher proportion of heavy elements. Saturn is composed mainly of hydrogen and helium gas, whereas the composition of Kepler-16b is thought to be approximately half hydrogen helium gas and half heavy elements in the form of ice or rock. The fact that the planet repeatedly transits both stars shows that it is orbiting in the same plane as the two stars, strongly suggesting that it formed along with the stars rather than being captured by the stellar system some time after its formation. While the discovery of the first circumbinary planet vastly increases the total number of planets that are estimated to exist in our galaxy, Kepler-16b itself lies outside of the habitable zone of its parent stellar system, so is unlikely to host life. While more and more examples of exoplanets continue to be found, there still remain unanswered questions about our own planet and its formation. Certain elements such as nickel, cobalt and iridium are classed as siderophile, meaning iron-loving, and are rare on the Earth's surface because of their strong affinity for iron, the element which makes up roughly 88% of the Earth's core. During the Earth's formation, the heavy iron sank to the core of the planet, taking most of the siderophile elements with it, part of a process known as differentiation. But these elements are not as rare in the planet's crust today as might be expected. One possible explanation for this overabundance is that these siderophile elements might not be quite so iron-loving at the high temperatures and pressures which existed at the bottom of the early Earth's molten magma ocean. While this explanation works for some such elements, it does not work for all of them. Another source of this siderophile material in the crust could be meteorites or asteroids impacting the Earth's surface some time after the initial formation of the planet, after the core had formed, but while the solar system was still thick with large asteroids and embryonic planets. While there is plenty of evidence for such a late bombardment, from studies of the lunar surface as well as the Earth's, it is not certain that enough material would have been added in this late veneer to explain the measured abundances. But in a paper published in the journal Nature, a team showed new evidence for just such a process. In their paper, published in Nature in September, Matthias Wulbold of the University of Bristol describes the analysis of samples from Issua in Greenland, which support the veneer hypothesis. Using new sensitive measurements, Wulbold's team were able to determine the content of the isotope tungsten-182 in samples of rock to very high precision. Since tungsten-182 in the early Earth would have mainly ended up in the core, any enrichment in samples of rock would be evidence for the late veneer theory. Using their new analysis methods, the researchers found that in most samples of rock from elsewhere on the planet, the abundance of tungsten-182 was what would be expected from the early Earth after differentiation, but samples from Issua in Greenland showed an increased level compared to the average for the Earth's mantle. The magnitude of the enrichment is exactly what is predicted by the late veneer model, providing strong evidence for the late bombardment being the cause of an excess, albeit patchy, of siderophile elements in the Earth's crust. It is thought that the Earth's growth largely ended with the impact which formed the Moon about 100 million years after the start of the solar system. But new research dating rocks from the Apollo 16 landing site suggests that the Moon is either significantly younger than this, or that the global magma ocean theory may not be the whole story. The initial impact of the Earth with a Mars-sized body is thought to have resulted in a young Moon with a warm magma ocean covering the entire surface. As the Moon cooled, it underwent differentiation. Heavier elements sank while lighter materials rose, resulting in a crust of light silicate materials surrounding a denser core. The first silicates to form on the surface were Ferroan anorthosites, or fans, thought to be the oldest lunar rocks. However, attempts to date samples of such rocks from the Apollo missions have given ambiguous results. But a team led by Lars Borg of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the USA have used improved methods of isotopic dating to determine the age of the Moon more accurately than has been achieved before. What the results showed is that the fans are significantly younger than previously thought, a mere 4,360 million years, implying that the Moon solidified some 200 million years after the formation of the solar system, somewhat later than previous estimates. The team used two isotopic tracers, the ratio of lead-204 to lead-206, and that of samarium-147 to neodymium-143, with both traces giving the same age. Comparing this new result with the ages of the oldest rocks on the Earth, zircons from deposits at Jack Hills in Western Australia, suggests that the Moon differentiated some 30 million years after the Earth, implying either that it accreted very slowly, or kept enough internal heat to delay the solidification of the surface magma ocean. The alternative explanation is that the sample is not from cooling of a global magma ocean, but instead is the result of a more recent melting event, since the magma ocean theory, which is used to explain the observed planetary structures, was developed using these rocks. And finally, September saw the launch of another mission to the Moon, the Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory, or GRAIL. Based on a tried-and-tested concept, the twin spacecraft will orbit the Moon, mapping not its surface, but its interior. The two probes are built using the same design as the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, or GRACE, another pair of satellites which have been in orbit around the Earth since 2002, mapping the planet's gravity field in exquisite detail. Although carrying several cameras, the GRAIL satellites are not mapping the surface, and the returned images are not the point of the mission. The satellites actually only carry one scientific instrument, a high-frequency radio link between the two craft, which will be used to measure the distance between them to very high precision as they orbit the Moon at a height of 55 kilometres. When one of the probes passes over a region of higher density, like a mountain, the slight increase in gravitational force will cause it to speed up slightly, altering the separation from its companion. The result of the mission will be the most detailed map of the lunar gravity field ever made, helping scientists understand events such as giant impacts and how the Moon's layers formed as it cooled, results that, in turn, could help in our understanding of the entire inner solar system, including our own planet.